At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Listeners, I just finished an interview with Dr. Tracy Neal Lavelle of his fascinating book, The Catholic Calumet, Colonial Conversions in French and Indian North America. This is an absolutely fascinating book to me. It's dealing with mostly French missionaries, mostly Jesuits, in the 17th and 18th century in New France and their relationship to the Native Americans there. And it's focusing on this issue of conversion. And what's several things interesting about this book. One is that while the author, Tracy, is a specialist in history, he's a historian, he also had training in the sciences and in anthropology. And especially that latter training really shows through. This book, even though it's a history book, it's brings things alive. It feels like you're reading something about things that are going on right now. And a lot of that is the skill of Tracy as a historian, as an anthropologist, as a writer, and also the fact that he's using these really wonderful sources, the Jesuit sources that describe these native peoples. So that's really interesting. And what I find, especially as someone who studies focusing mostly on Korean Catholicism and the interaction between the French missionaries and the Koreans there, is how well he shows these two group of people together and their own interactions. It's really, you get a real sense of the personalities, of the cultures, of the religious beliefs of both the Native Americans and the French missionaries and how they're interacting with each other. And one of Tracy's goals here was to show the agency that these people had in shaping their relationships on both sides, both the Native Americans and the French Jesuits. And that also comes through very strongly. So I think this is a really important book. I think it's something a lot of people will get a lot out of. So I hope that you will listen to it and enjoy the interview. Thanks. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Christian Studies. I'm Dr. Franklin Rausch of Lander University, the host of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Dr. Tracy Lavelle about his new book, The Catholic Calumet. Tracy, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, thank you for joining us. We're great. We're really happy to have you here. So I wonder if you could start the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, I'll tell you a little bit about where I am right now. I am Associate Dean in the College of Arts and Sciences at Creighton University, for humanities and fine arts. Been in the dean's office only since last summer. Before that, I was in the Department of History. I'm an associate professor of history at Creighton, and I was chair of the department. I'm also director of the Digital Humanities Initiative at Creighton and interim director of Native American Studies.
That's a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot. I've ended up doing a lot of administrative work. I've been at Creighton for 11 years. For those people who don't know, Creighton is a Jesuit Catholic in the College of Arts and Sciences, a liberal arts institution in Omaha, Nebraska. I've been here about 11 years. Before that, I was at Smith College for a couple years as a postdoc. I taught there at this wonderful Women's Liberal Arts College in Western Massachusetts, and I did my PhD work in history at Arizona State University.
And I remember when we spoke earlier, you had mentioned that you didn't start off in history.
No, it took a while to get there. I had planned most of my life. I grew up in West Texas. I I always intended to be a scientist, and prepared to do that all the way into college. And I went to Dartmouth College, and was really lucky there. I guess in the best liberal arts tradition, you know, I had a chance to study a lot of different things, which was something I really wanted. And I happened to start taking courses in anthropology and then eventually in Native American studies. And there's a well-established Native American studies program and some really amazing scholars there that I had the good fortune to study with, people like Colin Calloway, Michael Green, who's now at North Carolina, and Sergei Kahn, who's an anthropologist. And that really, I think I reconnected with my deep interest in the history of North America, something that I had always had, but had never really considered, you know, I guess a career option. So it was basically just an opportunity that I took.
Oh no, that's really great. And especially that your anthropology background really shows up in the book. And for our readers, one thing that's really neat is, even though this book is focusing on the later 17th and the 18th centuries, there's really a lot of ethnographic detail. It almost reads like it was written about something that was going on today.
Yeah. You know, so my degree at Dartmouth was in anthropology, and Native American studies. And so I had this kind of anguished decision when I just wanted to go to graduate school. I spent a lot of time thinking about whether I wanted to study anthropology or history, and ultimately decided on history because I believe that's just the way my brain works. I tend to think historically. The questions that I kept asking again and again were historical in nature. So that's what I ended up doing, but I still have an interest in anthropology. I read a lot of anthropology, and it's actually essential to understanding the source material I used. If one tried to approach it just as the source material, just as documents out of their ethnographic context, you would be missing a great deal.
Right. Well, like I said, this book really does a wonderful job of getting a lot of detail. So could you tell me a little bit then what attracted you to Native Americans?
Well, that's an interesting story. I mean, I think there were a couple of things. I mean, first of all, like I said, I grew up in West Texas in the Panhandle, and I was always aware of the fact that I lived in Comanche country. And, you know, there were historic sites around, and it was just an awareness I had. And then on one side of my family is from northeastern Wyoming and western South Dakota, which is, very close to the Lakota reservations and, the Black Hills. And so it's Cheyenne and Lakota country and a lot of other Native peoples around there. And there was evidence of, Native presence all around, but including on the ranch that my mother grew up on. And then while I was at Dartmouth, because I had started taking these classes, I actually took a couple of years off to travel and work. And I spent a lot of time traveling around the United States and Canada, and came, I guess, to appreciate the much longer, deeper history of this continent. And also how little I knew about it. And that gave me a lot of inspiration to try to understand the longer human history of North America.
Right, right. That really, so how then did you make the shift, though? You said you're studying Comanche country, but these are not Comanche. These are Illinois and other Native American groups.
Yeah, that was because I saw a particular opportunity with wonderful sources. And as you know, that one of the main sets of sources that I use in the book are the Jesuit Relations, which are very well known because they were published at the turn of the 20th century and, you know, compiled and edited by Reuben Gold Thwaites. And it's 70 plus volumes of material in the original language, mostly French, and then in English translation. And it's a set of sources that scholars have used for a very long time. And I just remember being introduced to them through some reading I was doing in an anthropology class on Native Christianity, and being in the library and looking at this, you know, I mean, you're like in the stacks and you're looking at 70 volumes of material, and you just pick one off the shelf and look in it, and there's just amazing stories and amazing material in there. So when I ended up in graduate school and I was thinking, well, what do I want to write about here? That was at the top of my list. I had some other ideas, but it ended up at the top of my list mainly because I saw some opportunities to, you know, to do some things in this field.
But yeah, those are really fascinating sources. And I like, you pick out a really good one in the introduction of your book, this meeting of the in 1730, the Illinois with the French in the New Orleans.
Yes. Well, it took me a long time to settle on that story. Just about the last thing I did was come up with the title of the book, The Catholic Calumet. And the first story explains where that comes from. And it also says something about the intervention I was trying to make here, the conversation I wanted to have with other scholars and with readers. And that is, so in 1730, this group of Illinois Indians, led by two men named Chicago and Mamantuensa, travel down from Illinois to meet with the governor in New Orleans. And when they get there, they stay for a while, and the people in New Orleans are really amazed because they are they appear to be devout, practicing Catholics. So they, in this episode that really astonished people, they participated in a Gregorian chant with some Ursuline nuns, where the nuns were chanting in Latin and the Illinois were chanting alternating in their own language, and they would go to Mass and stuff like that. But one of the things they did as part of the tradition of gift exchange, which is very important to diplomacy, they presented two calumets, or ceremonial pipes. People have seen these pipes. I think they know what they look like. They're long-stemmed pipes with a stone, carved stone bowl made out of pipestone. And they presented two of them to the French governor, one to signify the alliance, the diplomatic relationship, but another to symbolize their attachment to Catholicism. And I call that one the Catholic Calumet. So the story is really about how something like that happens, how you have this native object or native practices that are transformed by this encounter. So this calumet, this pipe, carried new meaning that came out of this encounter. And so I'm also on the other side interested in how the French changed as well, about how they learned to participate in these ceremonies and, you know, in some cases accept the kind of ambiguous meaning that came out of these encounters.
Yeah, that's one thing I really got a lot out of your book, was this idea of a mutual conversion, that it wasn't just the Native Americans in a sense becoming Catholic, but in a sense the French also had to become Native Americans.
Yes, I think I had been frustrated in looking at a lot of material where on the native side, if you look at native Christianity, indigenous Christianity, on the one hand, people, scholars asking the question, were these conversions real? You know, were these people really Catholic or Christian? And I think that's the wrong question to ask, because the fact is there were changes, and I don't think that, you know, in my definition of conversion, which I spend a lot of time on, I don't think conversion represents, you know, a transformation from one settled state to another. I talk about conversion as a cross-cultural practice. It's a set of practices. It's not a state of being. And on the other hand, sometimes people have criticized Native Christians for being inauthentic Indians, you know, for turning their back on Native, on their Native communities and Native cultures. And you can see that the process of conversion in these places and times, that is not at all what happened. But on the other hand, you know, the missionaries in particular that I focus on, the Jesuit, French Jesuits, they underwent a lot of transformative experiences themselves. And this is intentional. They were there in part as a project of self-transformation, a kind of self-conversion. They were having a spiritual experience too. So I try to document that.
Right. No, that was really fascinating. And that was one thing I also appreciated, was that you spent a good deal of time talking about the spiritual exercises.
Yes. You know, the spiritual exercises are the foundation for Jesuit spirituality. Ignatius of Loyola, the founder of the Jesuits, before he started, the Jesuits were founded in 1540 officially by the Pope. But before that, Ignatius, who was from Spain, was traveling and was in the midst of a spiritual crisis, spent a lot of time meditating and praying and thinking in a cave, and developed the spiritual exercises, which are basically it's a retreat guide, but it gives it provides the foundation for Jesuit spirituality. So all Jesuits in formation go through, you know, a 30-day silent retreat with the Jesuit relations, but they've also, anyone can take can do a version of Jesuit relations. So they'll do 8-day retreats for lay people. They've done that, you know, since the beginning of the order. But yeah, that provides the orientation for what it means to give yourself over to God. So to empty yourself of your own will, so that you make space for God's will.
Right. And I really appreciate that you got that in there, because I do a lot of work with Catholicism and Korean, and a lot of times the missionaries are kind of ignored, and their kind of spirituality is down, can be read just as representatives of their nation. So instead of being French, or I'm sorry, instead of being Catholic missionaries, the emphasis tends to be, well, they were French.
Yeah, and that's common. One of the things that I was trying to argue against is this view that the missionaries were nothing more than instruments of colonialism. And it's not that I don't deny that they were part of a aggressive colonial apparatus, and that they were, I document many cases where they do things that are highly destructive to native cultures and native people. So I don't deny that. But my point is that everyone who is involved in this, you know, I want to see them all as human, as agents in this history, and really understand the range of experiences that people had here. So that means treating the missionaries not just as kind of faceless representatives of empire, but as individuals with engaged in spiritual programs, right?
Right. Well, I wonder if then if you could, to kind of finish up the introduction, you could tell us about this meeting of these different kind of spiritualities and their mixing. In this wonderful story you relate in the book about Joseph, the Native American named Joseph, when he attends Mass.
Yeah, there's a man named Joseph who lived west of Lake Michigan and in the 17th century, and he had showed a lot of interest in Catholicism, and one of the missionaries recounts this really spectacular event where he didn't get a lot of attention. He wasn't really having a lot of success, but this man, Joseph, was really interested. Joseph attends a mass that the missionary is saying, and at the moment where he consecrates the host, elevates the host, a key moment in the mass, the man, Joseph, falls to the ground, paralyzed, appears even to possibly be dead. Then he comes back and, from his faint or whatever it is, and asks for some very simple kind of rosary prayers and things like that, and becomes an ally of the missionaries. Now, I read this and I think, okay, this is really interesting. And he sees it as his greatest success, in that period. I noticed that it sounds really familiar, because if you look at some other sources, we have accounts of native people in the area that on certain occasions in the year would have these big ceremonies where native ceremonialists, healers, spiritual leaders would gather. They would build a wooden structure, just like the missionaries would build a wooden structure. They would have a ceremony, and at key moments, the people would be made to fall down, to become unconscious, right? And as a manifestation of their power, they would bring them back. And so I look at this and I suggest that, we don't know exactly what's going on here. I mean, we can't read their minds, but there's at least the possibility, first of all, that there's some continuity in the practice between native tradition and what was happening with this in the Catholic Mass there, but that perhaps Joseph was a kind of a spiritual apprentice to the missionary who was he was interested in the missionary's spiritual power in a way that reflected his his cultural background.
No, that was excellent. That's the kind of thing, especially I want to just mention this for our readers, or I should say our listeners, who I hope will be reading this book. Great for classroom use, because they really illustrate these themes that Tracy, highly recommend you have a look at this book. So I wonder if you could continue by bringing us into chapter two.
Yeah, chapter two is called Histories, Origins and Experience. And there I want to tell the multiple stories of origin. So I focus on the Ottawas in the Great Lakes, and I share one version of their origin story, the origin of the world, and I contrast that with the origins of the Jesuits. And the reason that I did that, so there's two things. I wanted to give the kind of origin story to of both a native community and the Jesuits to make the point that there was this kind of strong mythological background that shaped the experience that people had in these encounters, both Jesuit and native. So for the Jesuits, for example, they looked back at their heroic founders, Ignatius of Loyola and the first great Jesuit missionary, Francis Xavier, who were both elevated to sainthood in the early 17th century. So they, these were like towering, you know, spiritual figures for Jesuits, just in the same, I shouldn't say in the same way, but in a similar way that there were, you know, heroic mythological figures in Native communities. And then I also want to make the point that I pick up the story in the middle of the 17th century, after the Jesuits and Native peoples in some places had been in contact for some time. And that immediate past history also had a really big impact on the way things unfolded in the Great Lakes and the Mississippi Valley.
Right. Excellent. Yeah, I like this kind of journey through time we're taking, because it's so easy to get kind of lost and forget that these people had a history, like if we focus just on a few years.
Right.
That we need to consider. And I liked that kind of temporality you got there, especially the Jesuit connection with the with their founders. I thought that was really, I think one of the priests, right, you looked at was constantly invoking St. Francis Xavier.
Yes, it was very common. I used this one. There's a missionary named Claude Alloway who was very prominent in the 17th century in the Great Lakes and traveled kind of incessantly, founding missions. And he left a manuscript that was a kind of set of personal writings, and he invokes Xavier often. But a lot of missionaries did, you know. So if you look at their material, they're constantly talking about Xavier in particular as a model, because he was the, you know, the first missionary. They reference the spiritual exercises a lot, and then they're also aware of thinking about and comparing themselves to the martyrs, the North American martyrs, the people, the Jesuit martyrs who were elevated to sainthood in the early 20th century, who were part of the mission to the Hurons and the Iroquois in the 1630s and 1640s.
So having told us a little bit about the historical background for the Jesuits, could you tell us a little bit about the Native Americans? And I'm thinking particularly about this myth about the muskrat.
Yeah, you know, it's I share this version of an Ottawa origin story, and it's a classic earth diver story, which is very common in North America and elsewhere, actually. So this trickster figure, this called the Great Hare or Mishabu or Nana Bojo, depending on you know, how you translate or where you are. He's on a raft, surrounded, you know, the earth is water, but there really is no earth yet. It's just water. He's on a raft with animals, and in sequence, animals dive down to try to bring back some earth so the Great Hare can make earth for, you know, make earth for them to live on and make a home for everyone. And none of the animals are able to do it. Finally, on the fourth try, the muskrat gives it a shot, dives down, he disappears for a whole day, comes back, he's basically unconscious. They look in his paws, and they open the last one, and there's a grain of sand, and the Great Hare takes that grain of sand and starts to spread it around and creates the earth. And makes a place for people, for all beings, human and other than human beings, to live. And in fact, you know, it's suggested that creation is ongoing. It's not a finished product.
So now you've taken us then, in a sense, that's a transition from time into space, which is what you're dealing with in chapter three.
Yeah, three. This chapter, I think, a couple of interesting things about it. I think it's the one that has interested people the most. I published it in 2004 as a separate article in a different version in American Quarterly. And it's also the oldest part of the book. It's the first piece that I wrote. And what I am trying to, the points that I'm trying to make there are that both missionaries and Native peoples viewed the landscape in moral terms. So the landscape held moral lessons. It was a landscape, it was spiritual in nature, and it contained stories. So these places, you know, the stories that that the Ottawas told, they could point to specific places and features in the landscape, you know, where these things happened and evidence of them happening. You know, for the missionaries, this was a relatively frightening place. It was a place that was outside the bounds of Christian civilization. So the landscape was read in moral terms. So when you bring people together, in this case, the missionaries want to transform it, right? They want to make the landscape itself, and not just the people, Christian, to bring it into that, into the boundaries of Christian civilization, into the kingdom of God. That creates conflict, because native peoples, even those who adopted Christianity, might have a different vision of the meaning of the landscape. And so I conclude by saying that that what you end up with are these colonial geographies, right? They're geographies that represent that don't represent the ideal of either native communities or Jesuits. That's something that comes out of this kind of ambiguous mix of people and actions.
Well, I think one area that that really shows is your decision to talk about the planting of crosses.
Yeah, it seems very simple. This happened all the time. So, in ceremonies of possession, Europeans, it was not unusual for Europeans to plant a cross as a claim to a particular place. But it actually was more than that. I mean, if you look at what the Jesuit missionaries were doing here, they were actually trying to physically transform the space. I mean, they talked about it in these terms, right? So in the process of the physical transformation, replacing native spiritual objects with Catholic spiritual objects, whether it was a cross or a chapel, they believed that they were pushing back the influence of Satan and extending the influence of Christ. I mean, in a physical sense. So it seems simple, but it's a point that I think sometimes has been missed or underemphasized.
Well, I think also, I think you're right there. And one thing I think was also interesting was then how sometimes the natives interacted with these crosses.
Yeah. This is where it's a good example of where the missionaries could be destructive. I tell a story of a missionary that finds a rock that is carved into the figure of it looks human and is painted and everything. And he knocks it over and rolls it into the water. You know, it's a site where people made offerings, right? So who knows how long it had been there or what it meant. That's all I know about it, is that he destroyed the site. In the contest over these spaces, Indians could respond with similar kinds of violence. So I tell a story where a missionary dies and some native healers have a celebration and dance around the cross in the middle of the village, and then they destroy it. They break it apart and claim that their spiritual power is supreme in that moment, that they've defeated a spiritual enemy.
Right. So yeah, it's interesting that these symbols they're still kind of contested, and they show how there's these different perceptions of the space and of the sacred. And that kind of this issue of perceptions brings us into your fourth chapter, which I love the title for this, Perceptions, _human, and other than human nature.
Yeah, well, thank you. It's very important, I think, that to understand that in these encounters, both the French missionaries and native peoples viewed the people that they were encountering as other. Okay, so it's very easy for us to talk about, because there's, you know, so much material on it. If you read the Jesuit Relations or other sources, you see the missionaries describing as much ethnographic detail as there is in this material. They understand native peoples as others. Not fully human, because they don't have access to the teachings of Jesus Christ, or they don't behave properly, or they are associated with negative things. You know, their societies aren't organized properly, et cetera, et cetera. But we have to recall as well, I think, to understand this, that Indians saw the missionaries as others. They didn't act properly either. They didn't know what they were doing. They didn't behave properly. They were strange, foreign. So this is a chapter about how Native people and Jesuits understood the other, and through ritual tried to bring the other into some sort of meaningful relationship. So for Native peoples, that meant creating some sort of kinship connections with they couldn't have a real relationship with them if they could not fit them into their society in some sort of kinship relation. So for the missionaries, because they couldn't get married, right? It was a fictive kind of kinship that was based on gift exchange and the way people behaved. For missionaries, the ideal was conversion, right? Was to get native peoples to convert to Christianity and alter their behavior in ways that reflected their vision of Christian civilization. So that's what that chapter is about.
Well, I thought it was really interesting too how you begin this chapter showing how these relationships could also change. You begin with talking having Father Alloy having two different meetings at the same village that are very different.
Right. So he shows up and he thinks, so this is an important concept. Algonquian speaking peoples have this concept of Manitou, which means, it has multiple meanings. You can translate it as spirit, power, medicine, a lot of different, it's a very complex spiritual concept. The missionaries tended to translate it as spirit, like as the thing, and less as the power that emerged out of a relationship. So they kind of had sometimes a slight misunderstanding of what it was. So Alloy, they called Alloy Manitou, and he thought that he was being referred to as a kind of spirit being or God, and so he thinks everything is going great, and really. These people were being careful because they recognized him as someone who was different, a different kind of being who obviously held some amount of power, and so they were being respectful. So they were being careful and respectful. He thinks everything's going great. He comes back the next year, and everyone's mad at him, and they're unhappy, and he doesn't get the same reception. He's like, what's going on here? And it turns out that in the meantime, they had had some other experiences with French, probably traders, and they were very unhappy. And the point that I make here is that the French, they misbehaved, right? So there were certain expectations for behavior that made it possible to have an authentic relationship. And if the French did not behave properly, including the missionaries, then they could be pushed to the margins of native society very quickly.
Well, I liked how you described also the perception of each other and their meeting as, I believe it was hopeful and cautious.
Yeah. I mean, they both wanted something from the other, but it was difficult. It was hard to understand. It's difficult for us to imagine how kind of, I think, even frightening these meetings could be, like the uncertainty, the ambiguity, and how cautious you would want to be. I mean, it was probably one of the most interesting things about doing the project was to try to imagine this.
Right, and I think that, right, that kind of concern, it really comes through also in this next chapter of in translations, because now it's, you've got they're relating with each other, they're trying to figure out how to perceive each other, now they're trying to figure out how to talk to each other.
Yeah, and this was, I think, in my view, is probably the most interesting, probably the most important contribution that the book makes, and an innovation, if you will. Because what I did in that chapter was I took, there are some surviving linguistic manuscripts produced by the Jesuits in that period, in the 17th and 18th centuries, some dictionaries, prayer manuals, and other documents that provide translations back and forth, tens of thousands of translations back and forth between French and in this case, the Miami, Illinois language. And so I studied three Christian prayers, I'll just call them prayers. So the Apostles' Creed, the Our Father, and the Hail Mary, and two versions of the Apostles' Creed. And I translated them from Miami, Illinois, into French, and then into English to see what they actually said. And there are some pretty amazing things that you find in these translations.
Right. I enjoyed the whole book, but this, because I have to work in Korean and Chinese and to a certain lesser extent Japanese, I'm fascinated by this issue of translation, how difficult it is to say things, because they don't, you know, in one of my favorites in Korean, they don't differentiate between mind and heart. So it gets tricky when you have to translate those terms in English, because we do. And so I just can't imagine how difficult it was to try and to not only communicate, but to translate very complex theological ideas.
Yeah, and you can see the struggle, right? You can see it happening when you look at these translations. So a couple of things that I focus on, and I've published, this is a separate article in Church History, and the article is called Bad Things and Good Hearts. And you probably understand this, translating this really complex concept of sin, right? Sin is not an easy thing. It has
right.
a lot of pieces to it. It has a long history in Christianity. And it was not, there was no term for sin in these languages. So figuring out how to translate that was a constant problem. Missionaries complained about it. It's like they would say, these people, they don't understand sin. So they chose a term in the Miami, Illinois language, Mariwaki, which means bad things, which is a much broader term because it can apply not just to, you know, stains on the spirit or spiritual problems, but, you know, and the whole range of things that can go wrong in a person's life. But it's another concept that's very difficult to translate is grace. I mean, if sin is difficult, I think grace might even be more challenging
right.
to translate. There's obviously no word for that. So they chose the idea of a good heart. And this actually was quite a brilliant idea, because they had figured out that there was this whole language of the heart in Miami, Illinois, that had to do with the way a person maintained wellness and balance And there's a lot of language related to this. So one of the examples I give is, you know, that in the Ave Maria, you know, instead of Hail Mary, full of grace, it's Rejoice in Mary, the Master of all good hearts, is the translation in Miami, Illinois. So Mary is someone that a native Christian could call on to restore balance in their heart. So if things were out of balance, if they were sick, and I don't mean just physically ill, but if they had, you know, problems that were considered, you know, of a spiritual nature, Mary was the Master of all good hearts and was therefore someone to call on for restoration and of one's physical and spiritual well-being.
Right. Yeah, I thought that was really, really neat how they there was that struggle to do that. And I was really struck with how things changed with the creed. I mean, and you really focus on this because, of course, the creed in Latin is credo, I believe. But what does it become when they translate it?
When they translate it, they use the term nitara mitawa, which means it's a better translation is I obey. You could even translate it as I pray to. And the thing that I think is important there is that native religions were oriented around practice, around ritual, around doing things, around relationships, and not around a set of beliefs. I'm not saying that there was no coherent belief system. That's not what I'm saying at all. But some sort of stable set of beliefs was not at the center of native religion. It was about practice. It was about relationships that one had and maintained with spiritual beings and with power. So nitara mitawa is a word that makes a lot more sense, right? They could have chosen some other language that would have been closer to this, I believe, but I think that they made a strategic decision to recognize the importance of religious practice here in their translations.
Well, yeah, it especially just strikes me about that decision to say I obey when I'm looking at, in the early 20th century when there's both Catholics and Protestants in Korea. What strikes me is how the Protestants are really interested in making sure that their converts like believe everything and they believe it correctly before they will baptize
right.
them. Whereas the Catholics mostly they want them to understand trouble. Well, we'll go ahead and baptize you as long as you accept the authority of the church and you'll eventually get it.
Well, there's a similar thing. I mean, they certainly wanted to see evidence of a conversion and they had very specific kind of markers for seeing that. But, they were interested in behavior as much as belief. I mean, I don't think they thought that they could necessarily read what people were actually thinking all the time.
Right, exactly. So I thought that was really interesting. I really enjoyed this chapter.
Thank you.
So now, you're welcome. So now we've got it set. We've got how they perceive each other. We've got how they are translating and being able to talk to each other. In the next chapter, you talk of when we're dealing more now with actual conversion.
Yeah, and this is the chapter. The whole book is about conversion, but I have a chapter that I call Turnings, Spiritual Transformations and the Search for Order. And that's where I elaborate a great deal on how conversion worked for both native peoples and for the French Jesuits. And I call it Turnings because of this. If you look at the origins of the term conversion, of the word conversion, it has relations to this, to a concept of a turning toward or away from something, a reorientation. So I really like the way that works in this case. It fits better with this idea that conversion is a practice or a process, and not not just an identity or a state of being. So I spend a lot of time, you know, looking at various examples of native conversion. I spend a lot of time talking about Claude Alloway because of his private personal writing about his own spiritual experiences and conversion. And then I tell another story about how one significant band of Ottawas, the Kissikon Ottawas, who had been displaced and moving around quite a bit in the Great Lakes, seemed to, as part of a mass conversion, use the opportunity to try to restore a sense of order in their community. So I look at different, you know, basically it's about the different kinds of experiences of spiritual transformation.
Right. Yeah, and I thought that all came through really, really well. One thing I if I could ask you to, is could you give us a little bit more about the conversion of Joseph Nicolaquita?
Nicolaquita.
I think it really gets a lot of your themes through that example.
Yeah, Nicolaquita is, you know, I was always interested. One of the things that I did was I went through the Jesuit relations and for this whole period in the area I was looking at, and I tried to identify every conversion narrative that was embedded in these texts. I have more than 70 of them. And then I analyzed them all according to these different variables. It's to bring some systematic analysis to these conversion narratives, and that's in an appendix. But one of the things, you know, a lot of them were unnamed people. So I was always interested if someone was named in the documents, right? Because then they become less anonymous, right? So Joseph Nicolaquita, a Meskwaki or Fox man, who was very ill and asked for the intercession of a missionary and is healed and believes that seems to believe that you know, the Christian God has healed him, and asks for material objects and prayers that he can use to you know, develop his own spiritual life, and he tries to work with other people in his community, but that sometimes generates conflict.
Right, right. And I thought that was really striking, and especially the theological explanations about it was kind of it was a win-win situation, right? If you were sick, either you got well and that was God healing you, or you died and you went to heaven.
Yeah, that for some people, I think that was, you know, a possibility. It's hard to interpret, honestly. Like, you know, so when I did, when I did the analysis of the conversion narratives, one of the things that comes clear, and this will be a good transition to the next chapter, actually, is that men in this sample were more likely to convert or to accept baptism when they were ill. So it seemed to be, you know, one could look at this and say that they were reaching out for a kind of spiritual power that might offer some healing. And this was not out of line at all with native tradition, you know, where you would call on a healer and see if the person could, you know, bring their power to bear in your life. On the other hand, women seem to have a very different relationship to Catholicism. So I saw a difference. There was, I guess, to summarize, a gendered response to Catholicism.
Right, right. And that makes a lot of sense. That's one thing what was funny, in the Korean case, a lot of times it was actually attracted to Christianity because it was in a explained through Confucianism, but later it shifted towards women. And that's how we then, like you said, this is a good transition to the next chapter. because it begins with this woman, Marie Rouvensov.
Yes. Marie Rouvensov is an amazing person, and she's pretty well known historically. A lot of people have written about her in various ways. And the reason for that is because we know who she is. We know her name. She was part of an important family, and there's an unusual amount of documentation of her life for a Native individual of that time, and especially of a Native woman. And so if men were more likely to be interested in healing and in diplomatic or commercial relationships as part of their connection to Christianity, a lot of women clearly were interested in expanding their social and perhaps spiritual power in these relationships. So Marie Rouvensov is my central example. It's an amazing story. It's 1693. She's a young woman, maybe 17 years old. Her father is the most important leader in her band of Illinois. And he arranges a marriage with a Frenchman named Michel Lacot, who's a trader. And she says no. And it had been most common in Illinois practice for fathers and brothers to arrange the marriages of their daughters and sisters. So saying no was a really big deal. She said no, and she was kicked out of her house and fled to some Christian households to get away from her parents. Eventually, she resolved the situation when she offered to get married to Michel Lacot if he would return to Catholicism as a practicing Catholic, and he agreed to do so. And then in the process, her parents made a public conversion to Catholicism, and she became one of the most important catechists in among the Kaskaskia, Illinois, her band. And they ended up being, over time, from the 1690s all the way into the 18th century, the most closely attached band to Catholicism. So she was a really significant person in the transformation of the community.
Right. And I thought, I know this was an amazing story. This seems like a very remarkable woman. I mean, very strong-willed.
She was amazing. And, yeah, absolutely.
And I thought what was really striking was how that even continued into her as she was dying and was putting her will together.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we have, you know, like Joseph Niccolò Quito, we have, you know, one main story about him. But Marie Rouvensov, we have lengthy accounts by missionaries of her conversion, of that conflict, and of her spiritual practice. But we also have her will. We have her estate inventory. She appears in the sacramental registers of the church, so we know that she was she baptized her children. She served as a godmother to other children, usually of Native women married to French men. So we have a lot of documentation of her life. And she became independently, she got married, remarried again. Michel Lacot died. She married another man, another French man. She became one of the wealthiest people in the region. She had a lot of land, a lot of agricultural implements, houses and buildings. She owned Indian and African slaves. And, you know, became quite wealthy. So when she was dying, she, you know, they did an estate inventory, and she dictated her will, which we have. And as part of that, she said it, there are a couple of interesting things, but two of the things that demonstrate her continuing attachment to Christianity. This is 1725. She converted, or the big conflict happened in 1693. So it's decades later. There are two really significant things. One, she asked to be buried under the pew of her church, which is a rare honor, and it's the only time I know of that this was given to a Native woman. And she disowns her oldest son, Michel Lacoste, who's named after her first husband, because he has left the settled French Indian community of Kaskaskia and has gone to another community which is not Catholic. And she says that if he continues in his behavior, that he will not receive his share of the inheritance. Then she goes back a few days later and dictates a codicil to her will, and she's softened her stance a little bit and says, look, if he comes back and behaves properly, then he can have his share. She dies. She's buried in the church under her pew, as she had requested. And eventually we know that Michel Lacoste Jr. Did receive his share of the inheritance, which was quite substantial. So he must have done something to satisfy the people who were in charge of her estate.
Right, and this is really interesting. It kind of reminded me of Chinese Catholicism, because they usually would convert entire villages or form Catholic villages, right. And it was a big deal if someone left the community.
Right. Yeah. It's clear. I mean, it comes through in the document, the will. She's very angry. She's very upset by this, that would have, the not giving him his share of the estate was a very big deal.
Oh, right. Yes, indeed. So that talks about the generations and families. In chapter 8, the chapter kind of wraps this all up. You shift a little bit broader to communities.
Yeah, and there that was a decision based. The sources start to get a little weaker as you get through into and through the 18th century. So I really, as a historian, I had to broaden my view out to a wider view of communities, but it also helps me kind of wrap up the story with the French leaving, at the end of the Seven Years' War, and the Jesuits. Actually, everything goes wrong for the Jesuits. You know, the French lose the Seven Years' War and are kicked out of North America, and over a series of years, they're disbanded as a religious order, first in Portugal and Spain, and then eventually by the Catholic Church itself. So the Jesuits are kind of destroyed as an entity. And so I wanted to look at how Catholicism survived in these communities with few missionaries, and then eventually with no missionaries. And then I end the book with this kind of tantalizing hint, which is, did the Jesuits have any lingering impact on the native peoples in that region? And in 1803, a portion of the Illinois signed a treaty with the U.S. government that requests, and they're granted money to pay for a Catholic priest. So I think that that provides at least some evidence that there was some ongoing connection to Catholicism, but it would have been very much their own. If they maintained that over the course of a generation, it would have been the responsibility of individuals and families and communities. Without the presence of Jesuit missionaries or Catholic priests, but there was something that continued that connection.
Right. Well, I thought it was also interesting because you talk about that connection. You also talk about this connection about how the missionaries and the Native Catholics are both seeking to lose themselves.
Yeah, well, I think that goes back to this idea of Jesuit spirituality, which is, I talk a lot about the abnegation of self, the emptying of the self. Suffering as part of the mission was not only expected, but it was desired, right? I mean, if you read some of the missionaries like Jacques Marquette, who is, obviously a very well-known missionary, and there's a university named after him and towns, and rivers and things like that. But when he wrote several times to Rome saying, I want to be a missionary, send me out, right? This was something that he wanted. He wanted to suffer as part of the mission. He wanted it to be hard.
Right. And I just like, there was just something about your phrasing when you talked about this that really got me, and that I really found profitable, and especially in terms of my own research, and that they recognize that they're different, that one group is French and one group is various types of Native American, but there is a shared spiritual goal. Even if they're understanding it different ways, they are still going for the same kind of thing.
Yeah, and this is, like, if I summarize the argument of the book, I mean, it's this, okay, that conversion is a complex, in this case, cross-cultural process, right? It represents a really complicated encounter of people, of communities, of ideas, of practices, and it was inherently ambiguous. I mean, no one could completely comprehend everything that was going on. It was not possible. But this ambiguity opened up spaces for a lot of creativity, right? Creative responses on the part of missionaries, on the part of Native people. And that's where the Catholic Calumet comes from. That is a creative act to take this Native object, which is incredibly important and had been incredibly important in ritual dating back centuries, maybe thousands of years, right? These ceremonial pipes, and to deliver it as a signifier of attachment to Catholicism, that represented a creative act that emerged out of this kind of ambiguous atmosphere of exchange and of trying to learn about the other, trying to understand and even control what was happening to people in the area.
Right. Well, I think that really is well stated, and it really comes through very clearly in your book. And I really would recommend our listeners to pick up a copy.
Well, thank you very, very much.
Oh, my pleasure. And, well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but if I could take up a little bit more and ask you our traditional question to end an interview at New Books Network. So, working on now?
Well, it might sound unrelated, but there is a relationship. I have shifted my attention to the 19th century Pacific, and I've been spending a lot of time in Hawaii, which I admit is not a bad thing. Hawaii
right.
is a very nice place to do research. But I'm writing about science, religion, and empire in the Pacific by looking at American Protestant missionaries, in this case, mostly from New England, the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions, who set up missions in Hawaii and the Pacific. And I'm looking at how the scientific enterprise and the evangelical enterprise kind of came together to bring the Pacific into the American imagination and eventually make it part it becomes part of American imperial activity in the Pacific.
Well, that sounds fascinating. I studied 19th century empire in the Pacific.
Well,
so a little more on the continent of Asia, but that sounds really interesting. Hopefully as you progress and you publish, we'll be able to have you again.
Well, I would really enjoy that. I hope to have the first, I've done a lot of research and I'm starting to write the first pieces, and I hope to get some things out in the next year or so.
Oh, good deal. Well, thank you so much again for your time.
Thank you for having me. It was really fun to talk about this.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Well, thank you again and have a good day.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you very much for listening to this interview of the Christian Studies channel of the New Books Network. Have a great day and hope to hear from you again.